Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On today's show, we're talking books, and this week's choices take us from urban wandering to Mao's cultural revolution in China via a dystopian African village. Quite a trip indeed. Talking us through all three is Charmaine Lovegrove, founder of Dialogue Scouting. Welcome to the show, Charmaine.
Thanks for having me.
Now, our first book today takes us for a walk around the city from a female point of view. Flaneuse, The Feminine Art of Walking in Cities, is a new book by Lauren Elkin that combines cultural history with criticism and urbanism. Charmaine, what point is Elkin trying to make with this book?
So Lauren is a native New Yorker who has lived in Paris for about 15 years. And as someone like kind of an expat who has found her home, then she's just really as an academic expat, she's really interested in the role of women in our society, in our culture, and especially within urban spaces. So being a Francophile then and a Francophone, then she's taken this word flaneur, which is, in France, you know, obviously they have gendered words, and that's usually a male word that kind of derives from sort of 19th century Paris and Haussmann's and sort of rebuilding of Paris and sort of Baudelaire and his kind of musings of walking around the city. So Baudelaire thinks that women can't walk around the city because obviously during his time women shouldn't walk around the city by themselves. And so what Lauren tries to do with this book is, what she has done in fact with this book, because it's really great, is distill all the different women, artists mainly, because artists look at the world in a really, really interesting way and from a really interesting viewpoint, and look at their position as women walking through the centuries, through these incredible cities that we know and love.
So, I mean, just going by the title, I have to say, I looked at this and thought, how on earth can this be a cohesive book? In its title makes it sound like a very bizarre take on something that's seemingly quite simple, walking around a city. But you're bringing up all of these historical contexts that most of us would not even consider when we're walking around a city, whether it's the city we walk around every day or one that we're visiting. How effective is the way that the book is put together and the way that these facts are presented? How effective is that in making you think about the city you're in, wherever that happens to be, in a different way?
Well, I think, you know, the term psychogeography, you know, people like Will Self or Ian Sinclair have been using psychogeography, and the term sort of flaneurs has kind of came back into fashion in the sort of early 2000s. So I feel like a lot of people are kind of relatively okay and au fait with this term. And what Lauren is doing is, and what she does to make it cohesive, is really like get into the underbelly of what it really means to be a woman and what it means to suddenly have the city, to have access in the city. Now, we've seen videos go viral of like women being slut shamed, like walking down the street and catcalled and that kind of, and heckled just by walking down the street. You know, there was a video that went viral last year of a woman walking down the street in New York, and what it means to just be yourself, be going about your daily business, and for men to feel as though they can, you know, they can throw insults at you or try and pick you up. And so I think that this is like a really timely book at looking at how over history and throughout time, women have had to adapt to the urban environment and adapt to their surroundings by trying to do something as normal as walking through the city. And I think, you know, what Lauren really highlights in this book really eloquently is the fact that it isn't and hasn't always been something that women can just do. And I think with global media and the way that we're seeing the world at the moment, what we're really understanding is that there's lots of things that, you know, there's a privilege in people thinking that there's things that they can do really normally, such as walk down the street or drive in a car. And that in certain countries, like if you're black in America, like you might get shot and killed for having a tail light that's out. And if you're in other countries as a woman, you're not allowed to walk down the street by yourself. And so these are things that we didn't know. And these are in parts of the Middle East, women are not allowed to drive a car. It's like, we're now living in a time where we're more aware of the fact that people are banned from doing things that we consider really normal within our society. And so this book kind of opens that up through the eyes of women artists and really asks the question of what does it mean to be able to walk, and sort of celebrates that freedom of walking and celebrates that freedom of feminism, of being able to be yourself in a space at any point in time.
Flanus, The Feminine Art of Walking in Cities by Lauren Elkin is out now, published by Chateau and Windus. Lament for the Fallen is our second book today, and the debut novel by South African data scientist Gavin Chade. This takes us to a West African village in the future that is visited by an alien machine called Samara, who's trying to escape an orbiting prison called Tartarus. Shamin, this perhaps isn't the most straightforward storyline. Can you set the scene a little better for us?
Sure. So I was sent this book by the editor Simon Taylor at Doubleday, which is part of Transworld and Penguin Random House. And, you know, he sent it to me with this letter saying, you know, this is for sci-fi for people who don't normally read sci-fi. And in my business, as a book scout, then my business partner Toby normally reads all of the sci-fi and all of the sort of fantasy. And I tend to read like all of the kind of cozier, literary, you know, and we sort of divide our books up like that. So I was like, I'm taking this to read it, because if it's for sci-fi for people that don't normally read sci-fi, that's absolutely, I am the audience. So
somewhat reluctantly having to take it then, I assume.
Well, I love the cover of this book as well. It's like this African mask. So I was sort of, you know, and I just sort of felt like there's something really compelling. So what we have is this African village kind of north of, called Arua, which is sort of north of Nigeria. And we meet sort of Joshua and the other villagers, and they're kind of living quite a, you know, they're quite a sustainable, cultural, slightly not affluent, but they're okay. You know, like they've got everything that they need. They have agriculture, they grow tea, they have technology, they're kind of experimenting with certain things. So they're doing all right. There's always this undercurrent, though, that they are building this kind of culture around themselves to protect themselves from sort of outside forces. And we don't really know exactly what those outside forces are until suddenly this kind of birdman falls out of the sky and lands in their village from nowhere. And they're just like, who is that? What is that? Where did he come from? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Kind of, no, it's Samara. And Samara...
Of course it is.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
So Samara has basically fled this prison, and he is trying to get back home. And he basically is trying to teach the villagers his way of life. And it's kind of this really beautiful exchange. And so then we see this kind of African culture and sort of 5 minutes into the future in action. So there's a lot of like oral storytelling. There's a lot of teaching. There's just a lot of like exchange of different ways of life, which is just utterly fascinating. And, you know, we're sort of, we're always feeling this like unrest from things that have happened before, like the floods that happened 20 years before, or there's like always sort of the threat of invasions from kind of alien lands that surround this jungle village. And so you're always kind of on edge and tense that something is about to happen. And what does happen is that this brutal warlord who has been sort of surveying the village for a long time is really angry by Samara's existence and basically tries to overthrow, and then there's a battle, and it's just epic.
Okay, so obviously with all good sci-fi, it takes us to the seemingly crazy worlds, the seemingly unbelievable, but they're all tied back to something that's very, very relevant to the time that we're living in. How did you feel reading through this? Did you pick up on themes here that felt very, very much true to life?
Yeah, and I was like, I should definitely read more sci-fi, because this is, if this is how it is, and actually, like, there's, you know, I really like stories with an allegory. I like the fact that he's kind of picked up on he's kind of picked up on Greek mythology as well. So really what we're dealing with is a kind of David and Goliath kind of you know, man against beast kind of story, and that it's really sort of good against evil and sort of the battle of the worlds. Yeah, so I feel like those are the things that we can all understand. We can all understand being a bit of an underdog and being somewhere, being displaced and trying to find your way. So I kind of felt like this is like a really interesting story to take on a plane for the summer, because it just really kind of categorizes like us as human beings and our sort of need for home and our strive to kind of find a home wherever we are.
Now, I understand that the story is based on one that he tried to write when he was just 12 years old. I mean, just going by the synopsis that you've given me there, that sounds really strange. I'm assuming that doesn't really come across in the complexities of what's actually eventuated, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that he waited, because I'm sure the 12-year-old story would have, you know, it might have been like a lost boy trying to find his way home. And I suppose it's like the Peter Pan story in a way, that maybe he was inspired by. And then obviously, as we all know, when you read more and you start writing, then, you know, it informs your story. So definitely, I'm really glad that he waited another 15, 20 years to actually pen this.
And always good to know that it's got a beautiful front cover as well. I don't care what anyone says. People say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I tell you what, I'm a sucker for a good book cover.
I absolutely love good book covers. Like when I get a book through the post, especially one like this that I wasn't expecting, and you open it and you're just like, it just looks stunning. And it does. You know, that's why cover art is really important. And that's why I'm a big fan of good cover art.
Absolutely. Virginia Woolf's books have just been re-released with brand new covers, and I just want to buy them all over again. Lament for the Fallen by Gavin Chait is out now, published by Doubleday. Now, if you tuned into last week's book review, you'll have heard us discussing the long list for this year's Man Booker Prize. This year's 13 nominees have divided opinion, but we're asking Charmaine to recommend one of them, and she's picked Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Canadian writer Madeleine Tien. Charmaine, what made you choose this one?
I had the pleasure of interviewing Madeleine at Soho House Berlin a few years ago with her book Dogs at the Perimeter, and she made me cry. I mean, it was just such a beautiful book about the Khmer Rouge, and it was a history that I didn't really know very much about, and it was just a very emotional interview. So I've been looking forward to reading her work again and crying, and I did through reading this. And I think what she has a really interesting knack of being able to place culture with history. So she did that in the Dogs at the Perimeter, and we showed a clip of some dancing from Cambodia. And then in this book, it's all about music and history, but this time we're in China. And it's just unbelievably epic. I love biographical fiction. It's like one of my favourite genres. And so I really love that when it happens with a history of a culture and you can have it quite succinct and someone's telling the truth. And especially somewhere like China, where you can't really get a handle on exactly, you know, what was happening in China when. Like, it's very hard to get a linear history. So that's what attracted me to this, and this is why I wanted to bring it to the table today.
Well, let's talk about the structure then. It's set across two different generations. One who has lived through Mao's cultural revolution in the mid-20th century, and then there's the children of the survivors who became the students protesting in Tiananmen Square in the late 80s. How does the author weave those stories together into some sort of cohesive structure that you're able to follow?
Okay, so there's a third group that is actually the storytellers of this book, which is kind of present day Vancouver. We meet Li Ling, her Chinese name, and Marie, her English name. And basically, Marie, when her father was 10, learns that he is committed in 1989, learns that her father committed suicide. And so she wants to, as an adult, kind of a young adult, trying to understand her father's history. But she finds these notebooks, and then she has to kind of decipher them. But her Chinese isn't very good. She can barely speak or write or read in Chinese. But she's really determined to understand this history. So what she does by going through these diaries and notebooks is kind of unpick her father's life, his relationship with a composer called Sparrow and a violinist called Zoli, who studied together at the Shanghai Conservatory. And essentially at the Shanghai Conservatory, it was kind of this amazing place where, you know, it's like great Russian and French and Chinese composers, you know, all of that, just the most amazing music, classical music was played by these unbelievably talented musicians. And so what happens is that during the Mao's Cultural Revolution, then it's the conservatory is destroyed. And so then we see sort of the aftermath of what happens to all of these people, these three people that we're following, what happens to them through the history of China leading up to Tiananmen Square, and also how all of that history kind of impacts on the next generation.
The book is Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeline Tien, and it's published by Granta. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guest, Charmaine Lovegrove. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our film review. But for now, thanks for listening, and bye-bye.